Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I travel to sit face-to-face with my guests in their own homes to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. This episode is made possible by HMH Vices. Since 1975, HMH Vices have been giving tires dependable service and quality. Made in Maine, USA, all HMH Vices and tools are guaranteed for life. The HMH Vice has an ultra-smooth 360-degree rotary action and an exclusive quick-change jaw feature that allows you to tie from size 32 to 6-aught. In 1992, HMH was instrumental in popularizing tube flies with their tube fly tool. This tool fits into any vise, making it easy for tires to tie on tubes with only a minimal investment. HMH offers a complete selection of fly tying tubes, including aluminum, copper, poly, and rigid tubes for any species, water depth, or temperature. Their tube converter tool converts an HMH vise into an incredible inline rotary tube vise. With a vise for all budgets, you're bound to find something that fits your needs at www.hmhvices.com. Tom Perro is the man behind Wild River Press, a publishing house that has produced some of the best fishing books of our time. Tom is an avid steelhead angler who lives in Washington State, so naturally, when I was there a couple of summers ago, I simply had to meet up with him. In this episode of Anchored, we discuss the magazine world, struggles as a publisher, and catch-and-release fishing.
I was born in Fall River, Massachusetts, home of cotton mills, the American Civil War and into the 20th century. I grew up in a nearby industrial town called Taunton, Massachusetts, or as the locals pronounce it, Tanton.
Tanton, huh?
Tanton.
Okay.
It's about 15, 20 minutes drive from the Rhode Island border.
Okay. Mm. Do your parents fish at all?
Both my parents are deceased. My father died when I was 10 years old.
Oh, no, that's really young.
And my mother just died several years ago at age 92.
Oh, I'm sorry. Was that the photo of her down there by your desk?
Yes. So my father did fish, actually, in local ponds and rivers in southeastern Massachusetts, where I grew up, mainly for bass and pickerel and hornpout, which is a sort of a catfish. And I remember his trying to get me to fish, and he'd always turn to my mother and say, "That damn kid will never be a fisherman."
What? Why?
Oh, I don't know. I guess I was 6 years old or whatever, and I was distracted, you know, running around. I was supposed to watch the float, you know, watch the little red and white bobber. And I was 6 years old. I wanted to go and touch things and catch salamanders and all that. Yeah.
You wanted to be a little boy.
Right, right. Right.
So then what happens? Did you fish throughout high school?
I did. That's actually where I caught the, not only fishing, but also hunting. And those times, unlike today, I think those of us who fished in the spring and summer also hunted in the fall. It was kind of a package deal. You were not just an angler, you were an outdoors person, a sportsman. But yeah, it really was when I was a teenager and in high school that I really caught the bug for fly fishing. I actually tied flies before I caught a fish on a fly. Not very well, but I did tie flies and was absorbed in that for probably a good year or so, which is quite a long time before I finally began to catch bluegill and sunfish on flies. Where I grew up, there really weren't many trout streams. I learned later that there were some little tiny headwater brooks where there were native brook trout, but I didn't know that at the time.
When did you come over to the West Coast? Because we're in Oregon right now.
I moved from Massachusetts to Oregon in 1984 when I was 30 years old.
Oh, you were 30. What did you take in college? I'm assuming you went to
journalism.
University. That's not a surprise. And we'll go into that later for any of my listeners who may not know or may not be familiar with your work. Okay, so you obviously finished your degree?
Yes.
And were you single at the time, married or anything like that?
Yes, I was single at the time and should have stayed so for a number of years thereafter. But
okay.
I wasn't cautious enough and that in the relationship department and dove in headfirst, and that didn't last very many years. But shortly after I graduated, I was offered the job as editor of Trout Magazine. I was 23 years old.
Holy, that's really young to be offered an editor job.
Yeah, and the magazine wasn't what it is now. I never would have been capable of doing the job, even to edit the magazine that I turned it into. But I kind of grew with it, and it with me. So it was basically the opportunity of my lifetime.
And how did that come to be? Did you apply for it, or did they find you?
Yeah, it's a bit of a story, as all things are, I suppose. I was a volunteer as a teenager in the organization Trout Unlimited. I was the youngest chapter president in the organization's history. I started my own chapter, the Southeastern Massachusetts chapter of Trout Unlimited, when I was 18. So I was involved as a volunteer in the region, in the New England region, went to meetings, etc. Long story short, one of the individuals with whom I associated, a slightly older guy, called me up one day and he said that the editor at the time of Trout Magazine was resigning, but that the president, a volunteer president, was a bit of an oddball character and didn't tell anybody. And wasn't going to tell anybody until a spring meeting 6 months hence. And so my friend from Vermont said, this is a real opportunity for you. He knew that, you know, I was doing some outdoor writing and aspired to get into the field professionally. And I said, well, what should I do? And he said, I'd put together a proposal if I were you. And he said, I know a bunch of key people. He was on the National Board of Directors at the time. Keep in mind that TU was a very small organization at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was staff member number 5, and I think there's like 150 staff members now or something. But so I bought a plane ticket to Denver in the spring of 1977. It was the first commercial flight I'd ever been on, at least across the country. And showed up prepared to make a presentation to this august board of directors, including the chairman of the board of American Motors. And unfortunately, the boys took me out for margaritas the night before.
Ooh.
And I wasn't much of a drinker at that time anyway, and it was a mile high, so I didn't get much sleep that night. But I evidently performed sufficiently enough that there I was giving my pitch, and the board voted right in front of me, and I walked away as editor of Trout Magazine. My mother picked me up at Logan Airport in Boston and said, well, did you get it? And I said, of course I did. and 3 months later, found myself behind the wheel of a rented car in Billings, Montana, driving through the big sky and living the dream.
So how did you end up here then, all the way on the West?
Steelhead.
Okay, so explain how that came to be.
Well, by that time, by the mid-80s, I had been, this was a full-time job, by the way. It was a very modest full-time job with a minimal salary, but nevertheless, that was part of what I created for myself, was the first full-time editor of Trout Magazine. So, you know, I essentially was wherever the magazine was wherever I was,
mm-hmm.
and vice versa, I suppose. And so I convinced, the organization was in a big growth phase, and many of us, it was a very small staff, and many of us wore several hats at once out of necessity. And so, for example, I wrote the membership development plan in the late 90s that helped propel the organization from 14,000 members to 50,000 members. And I'm not claiming I made that happen, but I was the architect of the plan.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of different things, and it's like a small business. You have to, right? And that's what we were. We were in the business of trout and salmon conservation, but we needed to get members and all. So many of us did different things. And I convinced the powers that be in the mid-80s that if I were on the West Coast, that I'd be a lot closer to California, where the organization had aspirations to grow, and that I could drive down there and start chapters, et cetera, et cetera. So
crafty.
So I was there on temporary assignment, and here I am.
Yeah, it wasn't so temporary, was it? So where do you go from Trout Magazine?
I edited Trout for 16 years.
Oh, wow, that's a long time.
And during the course of that, I won the Magazine of the Year award from the Natural Resources Council of America. I beat out Audubon, Sierra, and we were just a little rinky-dink, you know, the little caboose that could or whatever. So I was, you know, pretty proud of that, and the magazine was very well regarded. A new regime took over, a lawyer took over the organization in the early 1990s, fired all the senior staff, and downgraded the magazine on purpose. Now, in recent years, it's come back into its own glory. I think it's an excellent magazine. Now, in fact, I just wrote an article about steelhead in the Salmon River last year for Trout. So that was the end of my tenure there. It was a fantasy job. I learned everything I knew in those early years from actually doing it. Learned how to take pictures, learned how to interview people, learned how to do stories, all that. So no complaints here, but it was a bit of a shock when one day you wake up and said, you know, nice job, kid, but, you know, here's the door. So I suddenly found myself, that was in 1992, I suddenly found myself with no job.
And you're 30, I'm just doing the math, if you're 23 when you got the job, 16, you were 39 when all this went down?
I suppose so, yeah.
Ooh, that's an interesting time in your life to be starting new.
Right, so a friend and I, retired Navy captain, Peter Sovril. Pete and I had become friends during the late 80s and the various conservation wars and steelhead wars and everything. I was still living in Bend at the time and when I was fired and from TU. And so we got together and formed the Wild Salmon Center. And basically, it was going to be my job. It never became my job, and it's a good thing it didn't probably because the people who have run it in years since are far more capable administrators than I ever would have been. But that's actually the sort of root origin of that organization. And because we had no real track record, we couldn't raise any money. So it's, you know, the chicken-egg situation. And I had to figure out a way, you know, I was not born with a silver spoon in mouth by any means, so I had to figure out a way to scramble and survive. And so with the help of, notably, of Pete and Jim Van Loan, who owns and has for many years the famous Steamboat Inn on the North Umpqua River, those two fellows in particular were really instrumental in helping me raise capital to start my own magazine, Wild Steelhead and Atlantic Salmon, which I spent 1993 assembling. You mentioned the Miramichi a short while ago. I spent a couple of weeks on the Miramichi during that summer and interviewed Ted Williams, for example, the baseball player. And he looked at me at one point and he said, you know, I don't like writers, just big voice. And he said things just to get a reaction to see what you'd say. And I said, yes, Ted, but I fish.
Yeah. What was his response?
I forgot exactly. But so the year following, 1994, we came out with our inaugural issue of Wild Steelhead. And that lasted in several iterations for, I don't know, half a dozen years or so. And then we just couldn't keep the momentum going. There just weren't enough avid steelheaders and salmon fishermen to keep it going. And those who were out there, a lot of them wouldn't subscribe or wouldn't renew. And as you know better than anybody, it's an ornery bunch.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And so long story short, we morphed the magazine into Fish and Fly. And one of the primary investors, a fellow named Jim Ratzlaff, also from Oregon, he was the principal investor in that new venture. And so I did that for, again, another 5 or 6 years or so. And then the internet sort of, you know, overtook everything, and print was in the rearview mirror. It became more and more difficult to sell advertising. I found myself at one point, I didn't like my job anymore. I didn't like my work. I was spending the vast majority of my time chasing advertising, the creative aspect that I love so much, the photography, the writing, the interviewing. All that had almost become an afterthought. At one point, I actually became emotionally and physically ill. And so at that point, a magazine publishing company in Florida actually stepped in and bought the magazine from Mr. Ratzlaff and hired me. Oh. And increased my salary and gave me a big travel budget and beyond what I had had before. So I was in great shape, but I knew that wasn't going to last when I flew to Florida, met with the owner of that particular publishing company, and over dinner at a very exclusive country club, actually the Tiger Woods Country Club, where that infamous incident occurred years later. Over dinner at this elite country club where there were more servers than there were people in the restaurant, the owner, with great enthusiasm, told me that I needed to start thinking big.
What does that mean?
And
exactly?
Well, he gave me a specific example that indicated to me that I'd better spend my travel budget while it still was there, because this gig was not long for this world. His name was Rance, old Chicago money, and he said, and remember, this is 2005.
Okay.
And he said, you need to mount a trout fishing expedition to Afghanistan.
I'm sorry, what?
He said, you need to mount a trout fishing expedition to Afghanistan. Really excite people. I said, I remember leaning over my martini and taking a long gulp of air and saying, Rance, you're an expert at all this, but a couple problems with that. A, it would probably exhaust my entire $30,000 travel budget, and B, I don't want to die.
You know, that little thing.
Right.
So how long did that gig with that rant
last? Two and a half years. And then one of my colleagues at that operation, the editor of Golf Week magazine, in response to the Tiger Wood incident, put a noose on the cover of Golf Week magazine.
An actual noose?
An actual noose. I have a copy downstairs.
Whoa, golfing sounds quite controversial.
And, well, it was all to do with this Tiger Wood thing.
Yeah.
And so that sent that whole organization into a tailspin, and a bunch of people got fired, and major advertisers pulled out of their publication. And, you know, when these golf club companies, at that time anyway, you know, were considerably larger than fishing rod companies.
Yeah.
So you lose $1 million in advertising from one of those, as they did as a result of that, and everybody, it ripples down the line, everybody gets screwed. So that was the end of that. Mm-hmm. And so once again, I found myself looking, you know, on the outside with, you know, looking for something to do. And I just didn't, I had done magazine work for, at that time, what, 30 years, more longer than that, actually, because before Trout Magazine, I had actually edited a small fly tying magazine part-time when I was in school. But so 30 years worth of magazine work, and I was burnt out. I was just tired of it. I had done everything I could hope to do creatively. And again, with the internet and everything else, it was just, I saw no happy future in that work. So I started Wild River Press and started publishing books and on high-end books on fishing and hunting, and at least was rid of the pesky advertisers.
Yeah. Well, what's your biggest obstacle when you're a publishing house? The writers.
Biggest obstacle. Getting people to buy the books, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. That's pretty much, that's your biggest challenge, whether you're Random House or Joe Blow, you know, publishing out of his garage. Yeah, I mean, you got to make a product that's exceptional and that people want to buy and sell it to them.
Well, before we go into the book world, what about some of your most successful books? See, I'm in your house right now, and you have got awards everywhere. And a lot of the awards I see are definitely for books I've read.
Right.
Would you mind telling my listener your top five books?
Sure. Top five in terms of sales?
Sure.
So probably the most successful book that I've published, and I've done this now for 10 years or so, the most successful book is A Passion for Steelhead by Deck Hogan. We've been through three printings of that. In fact, we're almost out of the third printing. And I just talked with Deck a few days ago, and we're going to do a 10th anniversary edition next year, updated, etc. And probably then next on the list would be A Passion for Tarpon by Andy Mill, a well-known Olympic skier. In fact, I just, an hour before you walked in, I got a phone call from a guy from Florida who ordered a case of 8 copies of that book that he wants to give to friends who are going to Cuba with him this fall. I encourage sales of cases of books because bribery works. And it pays my bills. So then any number of other books, probably Atlantic Salmon Magic, the Topher Brown book. And you know Topher.
Yeah. And Deck's one of my favorites too. I haven't read Andy's book yet, but I will do that.
Then a couple of years ago, I came out with my first hunting book called A Passion for Grouse. And that was more of an anthology. And we won several national awards for that. And that's done very well. So, yeah, those are... And there have been several others that have done okay, but those are sort of my main titles, I suppose.
How'd the Sean Gallagher book do?
Sean, if you're listening to this, I'm negligent in mentioning the Gallagher book. The Gallagher book has done reasonably well, not as well as the Hogan book in terms of numbers, simply because the Hogan book is a how-to book.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how-to books in fishing and hunting traditionally and forever and ever, have always sold better. So the Gallagher book is more of a, as you know, is more of a storytelling exercise and the long form interviews and all that. So the Gallagher book has done reasonably well for what it is, and considering the fact that it demands a lot of the reader, and that it's a $150 book with 2 volumes, and
it's a beautiful book.
Thank you. Yeah. So I think, artistically, it was one of my best realized books, I think. And what I mean by that is when you have a vision of some sort, not to get too grandiose about it, but you do have to have some idea where you're going to take the product and what you want it to look like and what the form of it should be and what it says and all that. And I think we came pretty close to nailing that. Some of the others, and I won't mention any names, were a bit more of a bootstrap operation to get them out, involving, divorces and people moving and, little stuff like that.
Is it frustrating to you as a writer and as a publisher to see how-tos be so much more successful than things that maybe hold a little more, historical value to them?
I wouldn't say frustrating. Maybe disappointing to some extent, because the books that last are the books that tell stories.
Yeah.
And that document tradition and offer, I think, contemporary anglers and shooters a sense of their own past. Those are the books that last. And so what I try to do is I try to, even with my how-to books, and one could say that, for example, the Andy Mill Tarpon book, which has been quite successful for us, that's a good example. I've learned over the years to sneak in some of that stuff. So
I saw a bit of it in Deck's book.
Indeed, yeah. And had we done that again, had that to do over again, I would have been a little more daring in that respect. But so no, it doesn't frustrate me. It's just a reality. The people who buy books, at least historically, that's all changing radically with the internet and iPhones and everything else. But historically, the people who have bought books, at least in the fishing and hunting genre, generally do it because they want to learn something. They want to know what Andy Mill knows about tarpon. And if you can get that information free on the internet or in any other way, why pay for it? And that's essentially what all publishers, small and large, are battling these days. To the average person, especially the average young person, you know, it's a free world out there. And if you can't Google it instantly, it doesn't exist in their world. I suppose I should have seen this coming years ago when people started referring to editorial as content.
What do you mean?
That's the new jargon for, you know, we for years and years in journalism, we call it editorial. It was copy. It was the written word. Well,
that's what I call it. What are people calling it now?
Yeah, you're an old soul to today's generation, to today's internet generation. It's content. It's treated as just as a
filler.
Yes, filler or something to attract people. So I it's just a revealing little tidbit that doesn't mean anything, but I notice that, and it's a copy or editorial, you know, and it'll always be that in my world.
Well, let's talk a little bit about publishing. So are you out of magazines now entirely? I mean, obviously you still contribute, but as far as
I am from any point of view having to make a living at it or running anything. Indeed, I have been for the one lingering thing from that Florida publishing company is that a pal of the owners operated an aviation magazine, actually a series of them, and convinced me to, as a favor to the guy who bought Fish and Fly and eventually stopped publishing it, I started writing a column called Outdoor Adventures for a magazine called Business Jet Traveler. And I still do that. I've done that now for 10 years. It's a bi-monthly magazine, and most of the issues carry my column. It's a brief piece, and I've covered everything from hot air ballooning to fishing, obviously, and some hunting, and a bunch of stuff that in a million years I'd never do.
You still won't do any of that stuff, even though you're writing about it?
Well, no, I never claim to have done it necessarily. I mean, I don't lie about it, but I'm not going to be on some kind of a cable racing through the North Carolina mountain canopy. That's not happening.
You look like an athletic guy,
well,
though.
Maybe,
you don't look your age.
Well, maybe when I was 12, I would have done it, but that Tommy no longer exists.
Okay, got it. That's fair. I'll let you get away with that. So because you are so, I'm going to go ahead and say outspoken in one way or another, I would be curious to hear your take on the whole print is dead statement. Do you believe print is dead?
Not at all, and really never will be, but it is changing. Books are becoming more things to collect, things to display. I read an article in the New York Times a couple of years ago where there are actual interior designers who, as part of their repertoire, depending on who you are and the image you're trying to project in Manhattan, will prescribe certain stacks of certain titles of books that should be displayed in such a way that, for example, social photographers, society photographers coming in, taking pictures of a family or couples or whatever, will see the right titles in the image. Laughable, yes, but that is sort of an indication of where things are going to a degree. Again, it gets back to the old content business and what one is looking for. I belong to several professional publishing associations, so I'm deluged with email information and actually some print newsletters still, and not fuss dinosaurs still around to read that stuff. And actually, a couple of years ago, there was an uptick in the sale of printed books that coincided with a fairly dramatic decline in ebooks. So I think, you know, to answer your question, I think it's kind of stabilized. I think that from here on in, run-of-the-mill books, novels, for example, are definitely the purview of more educated people, and in particular women, and the statistics back this up. Even with my fishing and hunting books, from approximately mid-November through Christmas, well more than half of my sales are to women. They buy them as gifts, and a literate, educated woman will look at one of my big, colorful books and won't even $100? Sure. Her husband, boyfriend, son, whatever, will love it. Whereas many men, not all, but many men will look at that $100 price tag and imagine they could go to Morton's and have a big steak for it.
Coming up, Tom and I continue our discussion. Again, thank you to HMH Vices for making this episode possible. If you've been hoping to start tying tube flies this winter, HMH has got you covered. The HMH Universal Tube Fly Kit is an easy-to-use system of interchangeable tubes, tools, and techniques that lets you tie any style of floating or sinking tube fly for both freshwater and saltwater game fish. Plus, the DVD in this package gets you tying tube flies right away. The kit includes an HMH Tube Fly DVD, starter tube fly tool, stainless pins for the tube tool, polytubes, rigid plastic tubes, microtubing, hook holder tubing, aluminum and copper tubes, and custom and standard cone heads. If you're looking for everything you need to get started, check out www.hmhvices.com.
One of the problems, incidentally, and this touches on it, one of the problems in getting back to your original question about what's the major challenge facing a publisher, selling books, you know, but also part and parcel of that dilemma, that quandary, is that newspapers are going away, and newspapers are definitely going away.
But that was so, and I hate to interrupt you, but when I meant print is dead, I didn't even stop to contemplate that print in books is dead, because I'm ignorantly just thinking about me, and,
right.
and I personally can never see books going, you know, becoming dead.
Right.
But I meant in newspaper and magazines.
Right. Well, newspapers historically have been a great source of book reviews, and over the last decade or so, the vast majority of papers, even big papers, have cut out a lot of the space that they've devoted to book reviews. So it's more and more difficult for a publisher, again, large or small, to get that kind of exposure. So that just puts another obstacle in our way. There have been some bright notes for me, though, when we came out with the Grouse book a couple years ago. One of the Minnesota papers. Minnesota, incidentally, the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, has the most literate populace in the United States, and they have the highest per capita listeners to national public radio. And so you want to sell books, you go to the land of Garrison Keillor. And I had the great fortune to have a full-page review in the sports section of one of the papers. I think it was the St. Paul Star Tribune, 10 days before Christmas, and it was a glowing review, and of course the people reading it, the good Lutherans, grouse-hunting Lutherans of the upper Midwest, had no idea where area code 425 was, so my telephone started ringing at 4:30 in the morning.
Oh, no.
And this is joy, and it didn't stop for 48 hours, and when the dust settled, I had sold 150 copies of a $100 grouse book. People hadn't even seen it. They just heard it was good and it sounded good, and people ordering multiple copies. Oh, my husband will love this. My son will love it. And what do you think? And I said, lady, if they don't, you send it back, because they're going to love it.
Does Amazon affect your business?
It does, only when I allow it to.
Okay, how so?
If a publisher, they're the evil empire.
Amazon.
Yes, to a writer in particular, and to a lesser extent to publishers. But excuse the cliche, but they really are the 800-pound gorilla. They gobble up everything they touch. To put it in simple English that everybody will understand, my book, let's say, for example, the Mill Passion for Tarpon book, you won't find it on Amazon, or actually you will, but you'll find it for some preposterous price of like $400 or something. Some character wherever has a copy and throws it on there and tries to sell it. I don't know how many of them they sell at that price, but bless them. But just using it as an example, with a $100 cover price, when a publisher gives that book to Amazon through a labyrinthine series of wholesalers, distributors, all that, all of whom take their little cut, and sometimes a big cut. When the dust settles, the publisher, if the publisher is lucky, 6 months after a person plunks down the $100 to Amazon to buy the book, 6 months later, if the publisher is lucky, and when the dust settles, the publisher gets maybe a third of that.
What's the writer get?
Yeah, the writer gets next to nothing. And to make matters worse, a third of my $100 books is about what it cost me to manufacture them. So it's not even a question of no profit. It's a question of can you even do it? And that's why there are very few books that look like mine out on the market. And, you know, the reality is that we all like a deal, right? I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not sitting here chastising readers. I buy things on Amazon. I bought, you know, I'm doing my Civil War project a couple of years ago. I hate to think of how many thousands of dollars I spent on Amazon. And a lot of that money goes to little bookshops all across the country and even internationally who happen to have an old copy of something.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a good aspect to it. But the raw economics of publishing books, especially the kind that I try to publish, big, colorful, lots of pages, heavy, it just doesn't work. And so the only defense I have in my case is to don't let them get it. If they don't have it, they can't sell it. It's as simple as that. So, right. For example, we're coming out with a sort of a sequel to the Mill book called A Passion for Permit this November, and people can look to a little blue in the face, but it ain't going to be on Amazon.
So are all the Passion Force books, are they going to be a big series that you're going to sell as a collection at the end of it all?
Oh, I don't know about a collection. I mean, it's kind of morphed into that. That really wasn't the idea to begin with, wasn't the plan, but I guess it's kind of become that. I think Wild River Press has become known for those titles. It's not, we publish books that are called other things, obviously, but I think it seems to capture lightning in a bottle pretty well. That's what we do. We're passionate for this stuff. We're passionate for grouse, for tarpon, for steelhead. And I'm just fortunate that nobody had grabbed that before I did.
So how many books have you published through your company at this point?
Oh boy, I'm going to sound pretty stupid here, and I don't know exactly the number, but somewhere around 15 or so, I guess.
Okay, and how many have you written?
Oh, I wrote a silly little book a number of years ago called Till Death or Fly Fishing Do Us Part.
Okay.
I wrote the lead story to it, and then I corralled a few other people to talk about how their fishing has influenced their relationships and vice versa. So I suppose I could take credit for that. I also edited that grouse book. That I can't say I wrote that grouse book, but I was the editor, which means you're basically the orchestra leader or you're herding cats. And you're really herding cats if you had, as I did in that case, 25 contributors.
Ooh, no thanks.
Yikes. Nope. So I've had my hand in of course a great many of these books, and helped do a lot of the long form interviews, for example, for the Mill book and the Gallagher Steelhead book. But as far as a book that I can claim that I did in its entirety, it's my new Civil War book called Gettysburg 1863 Seething Hell. I just came out with that this past spring, and we've already won a national award for that and are up for several others. So it's on quite a different subject.
So what about the book you're writing now? A lot of my listeners are hunters, and I think they'll be fascinated to hear what you're up to.
Right. Well, I'm just off a month-long kamikaze tour that took me from Texas through Florida, Louisiana, with a pit stop, of course, for oysters,
yep.
Carolinas, Virginia, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and then finally this past week in Indiana. I interviewed 12 individuals who have the distinction of having killed a wild turkey in all 49 states where they exist. This feat is quite extraordinary. To the best of my knowledge, only 14 individuals have accomplished it, and I interviewed over the last month 12 of them. And they told me all their stories about how they started hunting and how they go about planning these trips and all their shenanigans and, you know, the relationships they've blown up along the way, and you name it, some real characters. All their stories are going to be collected in a book that I'm now going to spend the next 2 months putting together called Turkey Men.
And Turkey Men.
Turkey Men. And it'll be out next winter in time for the annual National Wild Turkey Federation convention in Nashville in February, which attracts, by the way, upwards of 50,000 men, women, and children all dressed in camo, a sight that I am looking forward to seeing.
I'm noticing that a lot of fly fishermen and women are getting into bow hunting, myself included. It's just something that I see a lot of parallels with. Are you finding that? Has it always been like that and I've just never known it?
No. As a matter of fact, that it's interesting you mention that, because that's definitely a subject that's on my radar. Because again, very similar to a lot of the audiences that I've appealed to with my other books, those folks are passionate, obsessive, and they spend money. Those are my kind of readers. So yeah, I'm definitely looking at that and have for some time. For example, Andy Mill and his middle son, Nikki, they are avid elk hunters. I mean, they literally scale mountains in Colorado. And, you know, a couple of years ago, Andy killed a bull with his bow and you know, near vertical heights and had to pack the meat down over 3 days.
Whoa.
For a mile, yeah. And this was after he had blown his knee out and had a new one put in. But yeah, there definitely is a parallel there. I think you're onto something. It's in much the same way that fly fishing in the 1980s was a way that those of us who had grown up bait fishing or lure fishing could kind of expand the sport into another dimension with a new set of challenges. I think that bow hunting is sort of like that today.
What about fishing for yourself? Do you get out anymore?
Of course, yeah. I not as much as I'd like. The last couple of years in particular, I've just invested myself thoroughly in the Civil War book that I just published. But yeah, I mean, I do some trout fishing, not anywhere near as much as I did, you know, years back when I was young, but I do get enthused about it. I was trout fishing last September on the South Fork of the Snake River in Idaho. That was an interesting experience. One of the few places where they're actually trying to get the biologists are actually trying to get anglers to kill rainbows because they want to get them out of the spawning mix and bolster the native Yellowstone cutthroat.
They are doing that though.
Oh yeah, and they have electrofishing programs going on spawning tributaries to get rid of the rainbows, and it was an interesting experience for me because I spent most of my life, of course, advocating catch and release, and I remember distinctly as a young guy in all those Trout Unlimited activities in the 1970s. In New England, I remember vividly shouting matches at hearings and various other public meetings where catch and release management had been proposed on different lakes and streams and so on. And the old timers were just vehement against it. And we were, you know, going to ruin fishing. And, you know, if you don't kill trout, what's the point of going out for them? And on and on and on, and so to see the whole thing come full circle, and to see today's generation of educated, well-equipped anglers actually having an aversion to killing any fish at all is strange and a little bit troubling because you know, we advocated in all those years ago, decades ago. I like to think that we advocated catch and release not because we viewed the trout as, you know, warm, fuzzy little critters, but rather it was a management option. It was an opportunity to catch them again and recycle them, or in a wild fishery to help the population recover and put more spawners on the gravel. But a whole generation, really a couple of generations of anglers, has grown up with this notion that trout should never be killed, or steelhead should never be killed, or salmon should never be killed. And that does worry me a little bit, because we are, after all, predators. You know, it's a blood sport. And I think that occasionally everybody should eat a fish he catches. And by no means am I suggesting that, you know, that we suddenly start killing Dean River steelhead or endangered cutthroat in the Yellowstone River or anything like that. But on the other hand, in situations where fish are plentiful, an example being the South Fork of the Snake, where you'd actually benefit the population by culling some of that, I think today's anglers would do best to kill a few trout here and there and enjoy them as a meal. It's part of the celebration of the sport. When we were doing the grouse hunting book several years ago, and we asked the Sidney Lee, the poet laureate of Vermont, to explain why he kills a grouse. And he said that because in eating it, it's a sacramental event.
Yeah.
And I thought that summarized it perfectly.
If somebody wanted to have their book published with you, do they send something to you, or do you source out all your authors?
Most of the books that I've published, I've chased down the authors. I've thought, for example, that a certain subject would make a good book, and I had an idea how I would go about doing it, and then sort of match the author or authors to the project. You know, I'm a very small operation, and I'm always open to new ideas, especially in the realm of hunting. You know, I've done mostly fishing books, as you know, in these last 10 years, but the market's very limited and appears to be becoming even more limited. So I'm kind of moving, not away from fishing entirely, but toward the larger hunting audience. And so that's why, for example, I am interested in this whole archery thing. And yeah.
Well, I look forward to following your journey and seeing how the parallels do come into play.
And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening.